all that I can be. And maybe one day God will show me what I need. Right now, I'm not so sure about myself. Will I ever turn and face myself and learn to fly? I've always heard that mirrors never lie, but that's not true because I see a man but feel a child. There are some of us who can hear a voice inside, a truthful voice that says, yes, you were born to fly, you were born to fly. We were born to fly. We were born to fly. So was I. I ask myself, what will I come to be? I have a choice now, so I guess it's up to me. Maybe I will make a difference in this world. Maybe I will teach another boy or another girl how to fly. Teach them all that they were born to fly. Then we were born to fly, and so was I. But when you live in a world that tells you that you can't, and when you live in a world that says you must be something other than what you are in a world.
Aloha, I am your host, May Leilani, and this is the Universal Spiritual Connection. Mahalo to all the listeners of BBSRadio.com and PalTalk.com. It is truly an honor to be with each and every one of you. It is a great celebration worldwide, and it's truly an honor to share with each and every one of you this joyous moment of the new paradigm, and for all of us to have raised our voices for the people have spoken. Our call-in numbers are toll-free 888-228-4494 or 877-489-6350. Our direct lines are same area code 530-776-5185 and 876-9916. And if you will please allow, I would like to read some wonderful, wonderful background information of about our guest for this evening. Our title of our show tonight is Webs of Power, written by Darlene Quinn. She is also an author and a journalist from Long Beach, California. Her first novel, Webs of Power, will be published, as we all know, in September of 2008. She is currently working on a follow-up to Webs of Power titled Twisted Webs. Ooh, I can't wait for that one to come out. Quinn has finished the Buddy Ebsen incomplete manuscript for the Barney Jones novel she titled Sizzling Cold Case, which was released in January of 2007. In addition, she has published articles in both Inns Keeping World and Savvy magazine, highlighting the business knowledge she gained during her time at Bullock's department store. As part of a 7-member management team for the Bullock's department stores, Quinn has the insider's perspective on the rise and the fall of major department stores. Quinn has become interested in storytelling at an early age, but did not begin writing until her adult life. Prior to being an author, Quinn was a teacher, a self-improvement and modeling instructor, and a private contractor for various department stores and hospitals. She has 2 children, John and Jody, and lives with her artistic husband in Long Beach, California. Let's all please give our guests for this evening a warm welcome to the show. Aloha, darling. How are you tonight?
I'm just fine, Leilani.
It is truly an honor to have you with us, and I have to tell you, the one word that describes this book that I have in my hands tonight is, wow, this is an amazing book.
Music to my ears.
Yeah. Well, it is. It was one of those books that once I picked it up and started opening up the page, that was it. I was done for because I couldn't put the book down.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. That's my intention.
It is very well written, very insightful, and there's a whole lot of truth in what you have shared with all of us in your writings on this book. But before we get any further, please allow me to share with all of you Darlene's website, and that is www.DarleneQuinn, and that's spelled QUINN.net. So let me ask you, darling, because I know you've had your hands in many, many things, and I'd like to hear if you would share with all of us tonight a little bit more about yourself and some of the journeys that you've experienced.
Well, Leilani, I think you picked up on my checkered resume. I have found interest in so many different things. As you mentioned, I've been taught in the public school system. I've taught modeling and self-improvement classes, public relations, and I was on the management team of the corporate training director for Bullock's department stores, and then on the management team for the Bullock's Wilshire stores, which were their specialty store division. I wasn't popping around to all of these different jobs because I didn't like one. I just kept finding things I liked a little bit better.
Yes, I understand, because I've been the same way.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you this, Darlene, because I have to say, I was just amazed over this book and the insight that you have really shared with us, and what incredible timing, especially with the new paradigm coming in and having a brand new, even though we're still calling him president-elect, I'm already calling him president.
I think that's happening to many people. He stepped
yes.
right up to the plate.
Absolutely. So what is the first thing that you would really like to share with us, and what inspired you to compile a book such as Webs of Power?
Well, I was in a very glamorous industry, the retail industry, that has fascinating characters. Many of them just crying out to be placed in a book somewhere. When I first started writing, because I was on the management team, and on Fridays when the merchants weren't in going to different places on buying trips, that's when I started to see the department stores begin to very much change, and many of them crumbled and went down. What was happening at that time was that the biggest competition of department stores were no longer dime stores. They were no longer even the discounters. The biggest competition that department stores had in the early 80s were other department store merchants. And that is when we started seeing the midnight sales. And then we started seeing stores having customers come in at 9 o'clock instead of 10 o'clock, and then it was 8 o'clock. It's been 7 o'clock, and I heard in Boston that they even start sales at 5 o'clock in the morning to get those customers coming in. But what was really hit me at that time was I grew up in a time where the after Christmas sale was something really special.
Yes.
With for Christmas, I'd like money so that I could take advantage of those after Christmas sales. But after that period of time, the mid-80s, the after Christmas sale has become sort of a non-event. It's happening all the time. In fact, people, at this point, it's hard to get people to buy anything that is not on sale. We've sort of programmed everyone to wait for when things are on sale. And that was a period of time I started to set a book using some of the fascinating characters I'd worked with, I knew, or I'd read about. And then this corporate takeover was set into motion. And all of the things that were going on during that period of time was a period I wanted people to know about the greedy 80s. It was the most greedy, manipulative, predatory time in our history until now.
Yes, and that's when the stores really lost sight of being of service to the people.
Right, we've lost a lot in service. During those takeovers, it devastated the economy, it devastated people's lives, and when big companies own the majority of everything, there's something that you lose, and service is probably one of the first things to go. And if you think back a few years ago, we had a Bullock's Wilshire, we had Bloomingdale's, we had Foley's, Burdine's, I. Magnin's, Robinson's, all these different stores. Now what was all those stores and then some are either Macy's or Bloomingdale's.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've gained something in there. You know, if you go right now, Macy's has 400 stores in 33 states. Going to the bargaining table, they have a lot more clout. They're able to get better prices. Those prices are passed on to the consumer. Is that good or bad? It depends on your perspective. What people are missing is the service, something special, the stores they grew up with. They knew the salespeople. The salespeople knew their needs. They knew when to tell them what was coming in. I can seldom go out into a luncheon or a cocktail party when I don't hear women saying, what happened to this department store? What happened to that? Is there any end in sight?
Yes. So let me ask you this then. Is it all about the greed and the manipulation with the corporations coming in and taking over? Is that was the main driving force was the dollar bill?
Well, in the 80s, the period, I set my book in the 80s because my book sort of parallels the takeover of the Federated stores, which were the Bloomingdale's, the Foley's, the Bullock's Wilshire, I. Magnin's. And what was happening at that time were, and that made it such a greedy time, it was these corporate raiders. It was sort of open hunting season on companies. And what they were doing is they were coming in, they'd have Wall Street partners, they'd have bankers, and with very little money of their own, they were taking over companies not to grow the company, not to grow their own business, but for the purpose of making money, lining their own pockets.
Yes. I agree with you, and we still have that going on today. Now, it's really interesting because through my own observation of, you know, just observing what's going on in our planet today, as I'm noticing more and more of these corporations are faltering. And so I'd like to know what your views are on about that as well.
Well, it's the greed of taking over more and more and more. And mostly, I don't think people really went into these buying all these corporations with the thought of destroying them and bringing them down. But they got into this mode of they wanted to win, and they lost sight of what it took. And so many of our businesses now are over leveraged. What has happened is they have paid too much. They might go out incrementally paying stock to buy these companies.
Yes.
But what is in the planning, they had, you know, nobody goes in, it would be ridiculous to just go in blindfolded. There are so many people that were involved. There is Wall Street, there's bankers. They had what they called number crunchers. And what that really was, if I pay this much for stock, what do I have to do to bring the money to the bottom line?
Yes.
I have to cut expenses. I've got to increase sales. And they got so out of sight that by the end of the 80s, the early 90s, our courts were clogged with bankruptcies, all of these things falling down. And right now, I know the men running the Macy's organization. They're wonderful people. They're not the people that I know in terms of the management. They
Yes.
care about service. They care about their employees. Actually, the employees are finding that it's a kind of management, and I know because I sort of grew up in their West Coast store, and what is now Macy's Inc. used to be Federated, and it used to be a lot of Federated took over all of these stores, including Macy's. But
yes.
as of June of last year, they took on their biggest brand, which was Macy's, and it's now Macy's Inc.
Well, it's just amazing with the markup on merchandise, you know, because, you know, I can remember when I would walk into these stores and you had a sense of family when you walked in there, and you got to know the salespeople, and the customer service was there. You know, they did what they could to be of real service to you. And what I've noticed as well is that, you know, they had a real focus on the people and their employees, and we've lost that.
Right. We've lost a great deal of that. I'm not doing a commercial for Macy's only. I've been doing a lot of research. I've talked to a lot of I was in the business during the time, and I know the period I wrote about, but I wanted to make sure that I stayed current because I've been writing, and I haven't been in the retail environment for the last 10 years, so I wanted to make sure that all of my knowledge was up to date and current because I'm now writing Twisted Webs, which is the continuation of Webs of Power. And what I really discovered is nothing has changed. The problems that we faced in the 70s and 80s are exactly what they are now as far as service. You go to a department store for service, and the people running department stores have two different sides. They have to serve the customer, and they know that. At the same time, they have to bring the profit to the bottom line to satisfy their stockholders. And it's always a tough balancing act. And if you are in a store that doesn't have the traffic, you can't afford the staff. But then there's always the question, how much traffic are you losing because you don't have that staff? And I know that, you know, we complain coast to coast. I've heard women complaining about the disappearing. That's something special. You'd go in there, you'd know that you'd find quality merchandise. You know that you would have somebody that could help you, that you wouldn't just be wandering around aimlessly trying to have somebody ring up your sale.
Yes. Or someone that knew what they were doing, and I mean no disrespect by even saying that, but I have found it extremely difficult to find someone knowledgeable enough to represent the products that the store was selling, and then furthermore is even to find someone to even help you.
That's right. That is a problem that is universal. It is, if you go to New York, you go shopping in New York, you're not going to find that so much. The only reason you're not going to find it so much is they have the staff, they have the traffic, therefore they have people there that can help you.
So let me ask you this, Darlene, because, you know, I'm seeing, you know, I have observed, and I know that a lot of the listeners tonight have observed this as well because it's hit our pocketbooks, that's for sure, seeing rising costs in our foods and all other types of merchandise as well. And so I'd like for you to give us your views on where does it give and why is this actually happening? Because I know that they're giving us many reasons why to justify for the high-rise cost of things. But as you and I know, a lot of it is very unnecessary.
Yes, I think it happens. It's not just the department stores. It's happened, well, you mentioned in food and everything else. And sometimes it's what the traffic will bear. It's a tough, if you're running a company, as I say, you've got two gods. You've got that customer to satisfy and you've got your stockholders. And it makes it tough right now because, and you brought this up, which you're very right, that it seems like all of this is happening all over again all these companies are in trouble. They've gotten too big. They've taken on way too much. And they weren't, in terms of what they paid out, they are not reducing expenses and bringing it through. And yet, what are the expenses that you can reduce and still not hurt your business? When you're talking about a service to business like a department store, sometime the very area where you're reducing your expenses might be staff, and in turn, that is damaging your business.
Yes. You know, what I see, you know, happening is that they're beginning to squeeze the people worldwide so much that what they're going to find is they've closed the doors on themselves. And I see even the large corporations, as you and I know, it creates a domino effect which filters down to the department stores and they'll all collapse upon themselves.
Right. It started, I think, maybe the late 70s. They called it downsizing. And what it really meant was having less people do the same amount of work. And that was where they were trying to reduce their expenses. And I think that's where you've got a lot of stress on the job. People are doing more than they're capable of doing. There are all kinds of ramifications for this. Are there just evil people doing it? I don't think so. I think sometimes it is that focus on that bottom line that they sometimes lose sight of what's happening. It used to be that you went to work for a company. You were loyal to that company.
Yes.
That company was loyal to you.
Yes.
And that's what we're not finding as much. And I think that's sometimes what happens when things get too big. They get unwieldy. Even, you know, private entrepreneurs have sometimes gone into a business and they keep growing it and growing it and growing it, and they find that they've lost touch with the people. They're not really even making more money because their expenses have gone up at the same time as what the growth of their product. So there's all kinds of things that are going on. I wish I knew the answers on how to correct it all.
I agree with you, and I, you know, if we continue going the direction that we're going, you know, because we are actually seeing where so many of the corporations and even our little stores, our neighborhood stores that we could walk into and feel that real sense of family, yet, but they were also providing a service, a necessity to all of us. It's impacting everyone, and it's interesting because what I feel what's going to happen is that we're going to have to regroup and rebuild and get back down to the basics once again.
I think, Leilani, that you have a very good point there. You know, right now I focus on the department stores and what's happened there, but it's happened little bookstores that you used to go to. They don't exist. Little tiny grocery stores. They can't compete with the big guys.
Yes.
And yet we've lost so much that is personal, that is something that means something to us.
Absolutely. And you share a lot of this insight with us in your book. And I'd like to share the title with all of you tonight. And we are discussing Webs of Power. The author, Darlene Quinn, and her website is www.darlenequinn.net, and that is spelled, the last name is spelled Q-U-I-N-N. I also would like to take a moment to invite all the listeners to my show page with BBS Radio. As many of you are aware of, I have a wealth of information about our guest. For all you listeners in Pound Talk, you will find Darlene's website posted for your convenience. And I would like to really encourage all of you to explore Darlene's website. She has a wealth of information to share with all of you. And it's really interesting because it affects each and every one of us. But yet, Darlene has written a book here, Webs of Power, that is one of those very insightful books that is very difficult to put down. She shares her wisdom and her knowledge with all of us and really gives us an inside peek of what's really going on behind the scenes. And even, because you yourself, Darlene, had a hand in having to train and oversee a lot of these areas within Bullocks, is that correct?
Yes, I was sort of known as the company shrink. I worked with a lot of the executives. I reported to the president, and so I was known as the company shrink. So I got involved not only with the business part, but a lot of the individual people's lives, the challenges that they were having. In any important business, there are the personalities that inhabit the pages of Webs of Power are people I worked with, people that I read about. I took traits from these people. There is not one intact person. However, probably the most bizarre character, the most unbelievable character I have in my book is someone I placed in Australia, and his name is Philip Slump. He's had 3 nervous breakdowns. He's had liposuction. He's had facelift. He's had hair transplants. He fills his pool with mineral water and goes to Austria for sheep brain injections to keep a youthful look. What I didn't do with that character was give him a wife and family in one city and a mistress and family in another. All true of the man who came in, took over the Federated stores, divided them in half, and ran them into Chapter 11.
Wow. And
I toned him down just to make him believable. If I used all of the facets of that man's life, nobody would have believed me, and I think there will be some readers that will think he's a little bit over the top anyway.
Well, and it happens every day, doesn't it?
More
it's absolutely
like to,
amazing.
More than we'd like to think it does. And I had fun with the characters in this book. As I said, I wrote about people I knew and I'd worked with, the kind of personalities that were there, but I took traits from them. And there were personalities that I knew. What I really like to share, I know when I'm drawn to novels. I go to nonfiction when I go to research, but I'm drawn to fiction. I love to be drawn into a good story, but I also like to feel like I'm getting kind of an insider's perspective, and I'm learning about worlds I didn't know anything about before.
Yes.
And I think my readers do, too. I'm trying to give them insight into things that they've heard or read about by letting them follow some fascinating characters and not having to work too hard.
Yes, I agree. Well, share more with us on some of the characters that you have portrayed in the book for all the listeners this evening.
Well, since I was paralleling the takeover of the Federated Stores, and I keep throwing in some names because I'm from the West Coast, and so Bullocks, Wilshire, I. Magnans is familiar to me, but when you're in the Midwest or the East Coast, you're not, so there's a Bloomingdale's, there's an A&S, there's a Burdine's, Foley's, all of those stores. Since I was portraying the takeover, I needed to put people in the places to make all of those things happen. And I took many traits from the man who actually was responsible for rescuing Federated after this crazy Canadian drove it into bankruptcy. And he was also responsible then, after getting the company out of bankruptcy, taking over the Broadway Emporium stores, taking over Macy's, which had been given the West Coast part of Federated, and more recently the May Company. But I put all of his personality, all of his positive personality traits. However, I totally messed up his personal life because I gave him a wife who was expecting a baby at age 40. A couple that lived a lifestyle that did not include children. Both of them wonderful people, but they both had reasons for not wanting to bring children into their lives. The CEO had come from a family of 13 children, and he saw his mother grow old way before his time, and his father turned to alcoholism and died at an early age. He felt that he didn't want children in his life. My main character, who I call Paige, has a secret past, one that she has not shared with her husband, and she has fears of bringing a child into her life. But she finds herself pregnant at the age of 40, and she needs to deal with this. At the same time, there is a hostile bid for the company that affects all of their lives. I also created a character, Bullocks Wilshire in the Los Angeles area, the store that I was on the management team for, is a Los Angeles monument, the historical monument. It was built in 1929, and at that time, department stores were all downtown. They thought this man that built a store in the suburbs had lost his mind. Why would you build a department store out of a downtown area? Well, we know that we're more in the suburbs than any place else now.
Yes, yes.
But
that's
I created
right.
This character, and I had him as a person that was the father figure of one of my other characters. But I did that so I could get real scenarios into this book. And go ahead.
You've done a beautiful job with this book. I mean, you know, as I had shared with you earlier, the only words I could really describe this book is wow and amazing. But I would really like to ask you this question, if I may. Would you agree that most powerful executives have similar characteristics to one another? And if so, are they all involved in similar webs of power, as the title of the book suggests?
I would say for the most part, successful executives, whether it be in the retail industry or any other industry, have many similar traits. They're usually highly motivated. They're able to make quick decisions. They have a great deal of drive. They have a lot of foresight. They have different work styles. What is very different in many of the executives is their work style. There are many that are absolute workaholics, and I happen to work for such a man. He worked very hard. There was hardly any weekend that he wasn't into the store, although he was president of this organization. He, in turn, expected everyone to do the same. A personal life was not, you know, your whole focus was a drive to the business, and there were some micromanagement. There are others equally as successful. This was a successful man. We called him the benevolent dictator. The salespeople adored him. He was wonderful to the salespeople, and he was hell on executives. I would say this man was probably my biggest challenge because I was head of personnel and organization development, and he would break every personnel rule in terms of talking to executives, and we would do executive reviews together and sit down, and I'd say, well, no, you need to say it this way. Oh, no, this is what I want to say, blah, 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 blah. So 15 minutes later, he'd call and he'd say, darling, come up here. He'd show me the review. He wrote it like I suggested. And then I would have a general manager after the review call me in tears, saying, Mr. So-and-so said this, this, and this, but he told me you said he couldn't say it, but that's what he meant. So he was unique, and he was, as we said, the benevolent dictator. There is another style of management, which is actually very prevalent in the Bay Company stores right now because they sort of came from this Bullock's Wulcher. In fact, the current CEO. And those are people, I would never have had my job as corporate training director of Bullock's if I didn't have this other type of management. And that was, they would choose what they felt was the best person to do the job, whether they had had any experience in that particular job or not. My first day in retail was as corporate training director of 26 department stores. I had run beauty and fashion classes, charm classes through Bullock's. I had done a number of, I was in charge of the Miss Universe, Miss Long Beach portion of the Miss Universe thing. I'd done a number of different things, but I'd had really no retail experience. However, the man that hired me, the director of organization development that hired me as corporate training director, all of the personnel directors were vying for that spot, so he would introduce me she came from Bullock's Lakewood. Well, what he really meant is as a private contractor, I did beauty and fashion classes there and charm classes. I did not have any retail experience. And it was a very interesting first week that I had as corporate training director of Bullock's because I was so excited. I was introduced to the CEO. I was introduced to all these people. I thought, oh, you know, I've died and gone to heaven. Then I went out to lunch with the executive development staff, and I felt like I was in a foreign land. They were talking about GMs, AGMOs, all of these acronyms that I knew nothing about. And I thought, oh, my word, what have I gotten myself into? Well, they weren't difficult. They weren't. So I went home, and there's all these things in the back of a training manual. So I came back in, and I thought, boy, I'm in good shape. And the corporate training director, the one that was leaving the slot, we were going, and there was equal opportunity. They were different things. And she said, an ETC, and I'm thinking, executive training, you know. And she looked at me, and she said, et cetera. And, well, I've never heard anybody spell it out. So I thought I'd gone to some strange land. But the management of that company really did believe in getting someone that was capable of doing the job, whether they had it or not, and that they would learn it. And they pretty much did. And one of the nice things about that is they not only put you into a job, but they allow you to do it.
That's nice.
It's not the micromanagement. And as I told you, I've started interviewing different store managers to make sure I was current in my retail knowledge.
Yes.
And I found that when I went to talk to a general manager in a Macy's store, I couldn't do it. I had to go through public relations and all this
rigmarole.
and I couldn't talk to anyone. So one of the men that I have in the acknowledgments, two men helped me at the beginning of this book. One was the man who eventually took Federated out of bankruptcy, and he is he's giving me an endorsement. And the other one is currently CEO of Macy's, Inc. And when I couldn't get into them, I wrote to him and I said, Terry, I'm running into a wall of secrecy. I'm not a journalist. I'm not writing a nonfiction book. I'm writing a novel. And so he sent the head of the West Coast, a Macy's person, out to see me. And gracious, they have been so gracious in my research. But he really, this man, zeroed in on the difference of working for this Macy's type of organization, which was like the Bullock's Vulture, and because that's where the training was. And he used to work for one of the other big conglomerates of stores that Federated took over. And he said the difference is night and day, because it was when he worked for this other group of stores, it was micromanaged all the way, and it was so refreshing to be in one where he was given a job, told the objectives, what he needed to accomplish, and was allowed to do it his way.
Well, let me ask you this, if I may, Darlene. Do you think at any time we may have lost the sense of the employees that work for these companies having that sense of family? And was there a price to pay with all the long hours that these executives, we know the one side of the of it is the stores have lost a sense of, you know, service to the people, and now we're dealing with high cost for merchandise and stuff. But what about their personal lives? Was there a price that they paid as well for these long hours?
Oh, absolutely there were. When you are in a business that is open 7 days a week, from early morning to late at night, and you are working for a workaholic type of boss, or you're just plain wanting to get ahead, there's always competition. There are webs of power at every level. And if you're going to get ahead, what I found with young people coming in, our young executives, they were expected to be there. They needed to be there. They were afraid not to be there, or somebody was going to get ahead of them. And it was very hard on their personal lives. Now, as far as some of the executives, as I said, I had this workaholic boss, but the man who eventually took Federated out of bankruptcy was not a workaholic. He was very perceptive. He was very good, and he had his eye on the business all the time, but he played just as hard. He was into the arts. He was into all kinds of things. But I think when you're starting out, and other than hospitals, I don't think there are many businesses that have the demand that a retail organization does on young people.
Yes, so we lost sight of the true value of life.
Right. We've lost a lot of that.
And we haven't we?
Some of that is turning back around. My son, for example, has very different values than I did. I want to take care of my family. I need time with my family. And he fights the workaholic tendency that he seemed to see in probably his parents.
I agree. I mean, I agree with that because, you know, I think it's important as well as for the executives of these large corporations and department stores or whatever the case may be, is bringing back those true values. And, you know, when you take care of the people and allow them valuable time with family, I mean, you and I both have seen where our lives have been torn apart through all of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Does the executives, are they starting to take note of this? Are they making those changes now to get back to those basics again?
Well, Leilani, I think it's kind of like from the beginning of time. There are those that do and those that don't. There are different personality types that go into it. And I don't know whether, I can't say it's all from the way they've been brought up, because you're not brought up just by parents. You're brought up by a whole society.
That's true.
And in terms of the values, because I know my son didn't have the same values that I do. He's kind of grown more. He's coming around to that as far as more with the responsibility and everything else. I don't know. I think people are wanting change. That, you know, everybody's talking about wanting change. And with the way that things are going, I don't know. Right now with the economy, there are hundreds of thousands of people losing jobs. That's not going to make people less competitive.
That's true. And that's where I had mentioned earlier where I was seeing, you know, this collapsing upon itself, mm-hmm. because they're squeezing the people out for, you know, just basic needs of everyday life, which they're basically shutting the doors upon themselves.
Yes. Yes, very true. Businesses have to be very careful, and those that are caring about their employees. Now, when I went to Hawaii, that's when I decided I'd see all these general managers in Macy's stores.
Yes.
And Macy's, Liberty House was taken over by Macy's. And I expected there.
I'm sorry, I used to shop there all the time, Liberty House.
Right. Liberty House, and so I expected when I was going in there to be a big backlash from Liberty House being changed into Macy's. And since I couldn't talk to the general managers, I started talking to salespeople because nobody could stop me there from talking to them. But they were finding a community in there. They're getting something in Hawaii in their stores, in their business. They have a tremendous loyalty.
It
actually surprised me because I know, you know, we're not happy in Southern California. We're not happy that we lost Bullock's, Bullock's Wilshire, I. Magnan's, Robinson, these stores. And so we're very discontent about that. And I was surprised that Hawaii, the employees, were so happy. They liked the way they were being treated. They loved the fact that they always had fresh new merchandise to sell. In fact, when I talked to this head of the West Coast of Macy's, we were talking about this, and I said, how is that? You know, I said, your people were just really excited about they always, and he says, we make sure that if something has been there 6 weeks, it's marked down. It goes out, and the managers do it, because if they don't, it goes out to jobbers, and they lose more profit. But they were happy, and they felt.
That is so true, Darlene, because that's where I received a lot of my own work ethics. You know, we work together as a team with a sense of community. We would always feel that our voices have, you know, had value when we would interact with upper management. Mm-hmm. You could tell that they had a sense of loyalty as well to the employees, because, you know, let's face it, without the people and the employees, you don't have anything. And so you have to take care of those that are of service to the general public.
Mm-hmm. Well, I told you about our benevolent dictator. He was wonderful to salespeople, hell on executives. He ran our stores in an upside-down pyramid, and the executives being on the bottom, the salespeople on the top. And that was an effective way to run a department store.
Absolutely.
Because nothing happens without the salespeople.
That's right.
And he was, you know, we used benevolent with the dictator. And executives had no special privileges. We didn't have any special parking places or anything else. It was focused on the salespeople. And I really think in running an organization, Bullock's Wilshire, we referred to Bullock's Wilshire as Camelot. The people loved that store. They would do anything for that store. It was part of their identity. Part of their whole makeup was, I work for Bullock's Wilshire. And they felt that coming back to them. And what I found happened, in fact, it was a scene I took out of Webs of Power that will be in Tangled Webs because the time sequence was wrong. But Bullock's Wilshire was hit with the, do you remember back the Rodney King riots?
Yes, I do.
Well, during the Rodney King riots, all the riots that were going on in Los Angeles, Bullock's Wilshire, which is a historic landmark, it is was called the Cathedral of Merchandising, was hit. They smashed windows. They smashed every single case, glass case in the place. They were on a shopping spree. They came in the afternoon. They were still there at 7 o'clock in the morning. The rioters. What had happened in the interim is this corporate raider had taken over the Federated Stores. They had sold Bullock's, Bullock's Wilshire, I. Magnan's to Macy's. Macy's now had the Bullock's Wilshire stores, and I. Magnan's, they put the I. Magnan's name on it. The morale was rock bottom, and then the riots hit. And what I was called back in to help right after the riots, and even though I had resigned before that time, what you saw in that store was amazing, absolutely amazing. They boarded up the windows, and they had children's art on it saying, out of something bad, let's make something good. A week from the day that that store was hit, it reopened. They could only do the cosmetic aisle on the downstairs floor because they had smashed everything. However, they did not smash the Lalique chandeliers. They didn't damage the walls, the mirrors. They were strictly on a shopping spree. But what that did for the people in that store is they all pooled together. They became one to put this store back together. It was amazing.
You know, and we see that all the time. You know, I always invite all the listeners of this show, is, you know, or I share with them, is why is it that we have to have something as such at this magnitude for people to become one, to stand and support each other? You know, and you and I both know two wrongs don't make a right. And when these individuals did that, went in and stole merchandise, they stole from all of us.
Oh, they did. It was actually that, it will be in my next book, but it was such an amazing thing because on this bottom floor there were all of the salon shoes. The only thing that was left in the shoe department were boxes. They had Oxford suits that sold upward of $600 each to thousands. Nothing was left. There was nothing left. Everything smashed and destroyed. A day after the riots, merchandise started coming back in. People from the neighborhood, you know, maybe it was their kids or a family member, they were bringing it back. I mean, obviously not all of it back, but there was a great deal that was coming back that people, you know, I guess somebody came home and you know, that's not right, and they brought them back. Of course, you know, we couldn't do anything with that merchandise that was already out. Charity got a lot from it. But it was amazing to see how, you know, some people had just turned there, and then they either had remorse themselves or their family took care of it.
I am so glad you shared that with me as well, because, you know, I love humanity so much, and I convey this message out there all the time, is that it's time for all of us to stand together, united, and to celebrate life versus, you know, having, because you and I know that it's all an attitude on how we choose to perceive life and everything around us.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It was a wonderful picture of what people can do when they pool their energy together. It was amazing, absolutely amazing.
I do have a couple of other questions that I would like to ask you. We are getting close to the end of the show. Can you believe it, Darlene? We're almost at the end of the show. But I did want to invite all the listeners of the show to, I'd like to invite you to my show page. As you all know, I have a wealth of information about our guest tonight, Darlene Quinn. She's written an incredible, awesome book titled Webs of Power. It was one of those books that I just sat for hours and hours and read it, and before I realized that all these hours had passed by, I was so engrossed in this book, and it's amazing how well written this book truly is. The insight that you receive about the greed and manipulation, and we're able to literally walk into corporate executives' lives, and Darlene has done a really excellent job on portraying each of these executives that she's had an experience to observe or work with personally, and why some of the things that we all have not only been touched by on a very personal level, but collectively as well, all the changes that have taken place, pardon me, with the rising cost that we're all dealing with, to why certain corporations and some of the steps that they actually took. I'd also like to share her website with all of you, and that is www.darlenequinn, and that's spelled QUINN.net. Before I have to say goodnight to you, Darlene, I know that there matter of fact, let me step back here for just a moment. I did want to have you share your views on women and climbing the corporate ladder, if you would.
Okay, well, probably there is no place other than department. Department stores are very important in women's history. It was the first place that we were able to go unescorted, other than museums. And it was a place where women started getting together, started talking to each other, wanting more power, and they started climbing up the corporate ladder. Actually, back in the 1850s, when department stores first started, the Bon Marché was the first one that put all these stores under one roof with fixed prices, and then R.H. Macy came in 1856, and he was actually the first person to make an executive out of a woman. He was the first to offer women executive positions. And from that time, they have climbed up the ladder. I think the department stores and the fashion business is a natural for women. They're able to use their creativity, they're able to use their intelligence, and they're able to climb up that corporate ladder. And they have sort of gone beyond the glass ceiling.
Yes, and they're sensitive to know the needs of the general public as well. It has been truly an honor to have you on our show tonight, Darlene, and I look forward to your new book that's coming out called, will be titled, Twisted Web. So that title again, I would like to encourage all of you to look out for it, and that's called Twisted Webs. And we've been talking tonight about her incredible book, Webs of Power. Thank you, Darlene. It's been truly, truly an honor.
Thank you so much. I love your enthusiasm.
Oh, thank
you. And I'm glad those little short chapters just kept you going.
It did. You did an excellent job. I want to remind all of you, it is time to let go of your smallness and claim your greatness. Love yourselves with all your hearts, and most importantly, love your family. Do not allow a moment to go by to let people know that you truly love them and support them. God bless you to all of you. Good night.
One day God will show me what I need. Right now, I'm not so sure about myself. Will I ever turn and face myself and learn to fly? I've always heard that mirrors never lie, but that's not true, because I see a man but feel a child. There are some of us who can hear a voice inside, a truthful voice that says, yes, you were born to fly, you were born to fly. We were born to fly. We were born to fly. And so was I. I asked myself, what will I?